and welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz, and might I say, Adam, you're a tough guy, Adam. 8 hours at City Hall with a Mars bar. People need to know this. He's a tough guy. Tough reporter, too.
I'm not sure the Mars bar part makes me sound tough. I think it would have been tougher if I had gone all 8 hours without eating at all.
Mm-hmm. Or the bathroom, too. But that's...
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah.
You can work on that, I guess. It's training.
Yeah.
Political training.
We'll train for next year's budget starting in January.
You might have to.
Open Sources is CFRU's political and for current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Just go to cfru.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of the screen. And you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast from Podbean on the Guelph Politicast channel. Today we will go to Ottawa and the PAC courtroom where Senator Mike Duffy is still on trial. The last week has been all about the titular defendant as he's been testifying about that $90,000 check and his alleged expensing the non-expensable, and whether or not he just didn't understand the rules. Lots of juicy stuff to discuss, so get your Snyder's Red Hots ready. I hope everyone got that joke. And then a more somber topic, the final report from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was delivered on Thursday. And you might have noticed an entirely different tone between the ceremony this week and the one that was held in the summer. But still, we'll ask the question that needs to be asked, can the government deliver on all 94 recommendations? But first, because it's Christmas and it's time for old friends and homecomings, we wanted to make time this holiday season for a good friend to Guelph and to political reporters here for the last several years, former Member of Parliament Frank Valeriot. Frank was the Royal City's MP from 2008 to this past August when Parliament was dissolved for the recent election, and we're happy to have him here on Open Sources for a strict, no-nonsense, and thorough exit interview. So welcome, Frank.
Thanks, Adam. Thanks, Scotty, for having me.
You're quite welcome. We're glad we were able to work this out. Mm-hmm. We were talking before the show, and I think perhaps one of the things that was difficult for you in leaving and not just, you know, working with the people of Guelph, but in terms of being there or being here on election night, watching the returns, watching the... I'm not sure if it was a landslide, but it was landslide-like. It was a trounce.
I'll call it a trounce. Yeah.
And knowing that you weren't going to be a part of it, you know, what was that? How did that feel on election night?
Well, there was a certain emptiness associated with it, I have to admit. But I knew when I went up, I wasn't going to be here, for good. Mm-hmm. I was there to serve in the interim. Until the right leader came along, and I had a family to come home to, and so I was still very much pleased that I had made that decision. But it's not easy making the right decision, mm-hmm. and so. I knew that I was going to be missing something really big. Bob Rae and I ran into each other in Ottawa last week, and he said, Frankie, you and I really know how to pick the waves. And it was so true. But nevertheless, I'm just pleased with the results. And when I did go up and, you know, went into our first caucus and later went up again and went into the government lobby and spent some time with Justin in the Prime Minister's office, you know, I knew that everything was going to be okay again, you know, that things had changed. And I just felt for some reason safer with respect to all the issues that needed to be dealt with.
Did he show you the secret passages he went to Peter Mansbridge?
No. Clock Tower? Did you go to the Clock Tower? But he did when we were in Stornoway years ago when he took me to where the leader of the opposition used to live. When Michael Ignatieff was there, we snuck around all the passages at Stornoway years ago. So that was good.
Found some old stubby beer bottles or something in the tunnels, right. Probably. So you've completely packed up from Ottawa, you're 100% back in Guelph? I guess you're never 100% away from Ottawa. If you're still
emotionally,
connected to the
psychologically, yes. You're still connected. Yeah. You know, you're still watching national news, watching every now and then. I, of course, turn on CPAC. But no, I'm packed up. I'm back at my law firm, Smith Valeriot on Silver Creek. A little plug. I'm starting to rebuild my practice. So
there you go.
Anybody out there that's looking for a lawyer, I'll offer the same persistent service I did as an MP.
Well, I think we need to – maybe we can do one as community service. Do like, I want to get some lawyer ads for him, like diamond.
Do you need, like, representation?
I'm shameless. I know.
Well, you know, you brought it up. In terms of getting back into law practice, mm-hmm. what type of law do you... Well, first of all, I don't think we've ever talked about what type of law you practice before and what you're doing now.
Well, right now I'm doing a lot of real estate, corporate commercial, like helping people start their businesses, continuing their businesses, transition of businesses from one generation to another, and a lot of estate planning, wills and powers of attorney, that kind of thing. But people call me for anything, and our firm services all needs. We've got 30 lawyers, and we can look after anything in the community.
Well, if I'd have known that a month ago. Anyway, that's an aside.
And your name's on the sign, so they had to take you back.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, let's talk a bit about your days in Ottawa. And I imagine, well, first of all, the campaign didn't sneak up on anyone. Everyone knew there was an expiration date, but it did start early. But I imagine even at that, there are things, a lot of things left on the table. There, you know, nothing just closes down at the end of Parliament. So looking back, what are some of the things that if you had a bit more time to finish, what would some of those be?
Well, you know, I started out as veteran or as the agriculture on the agriculture committee and then the agriculture critic. And there could have been a lot more we could have done for farmers. I mean, there are so many things ailing our farmers and our food safety system, those kinds of things. And, you know, we pressed the government to respond appropriately, of course, and they didn't. And then I became the veterans critic. And we all know how abandoned they'd been by our former government. And so as hard as we fought, we weren't nearly as successful as we'd hoped to be because they had a majority government. But we did at least expose this government with respect to those kinds of issues. And I think that was, as opposition, that was our duty. It was to, you know, show the Canadian people what things could be like. And frankly, I think, you know, between the Greens and the NDP and the Liberals, we were highly successful in you know, demonstrating that this was not the government that that would service the needs, not of farmers, not of veterans, and not of very many.
Mm-hmm. When you said you weren't going to run again last fall, you said you were going to keep up on the veterans file and in your private life as a non-MP. Have you been able to follow up on that? Or?
Well, I actually went up for the first, well, as I say, I went up a couple of times after the election. I met the new veterans minister. I've offered him my services.
Yes,
and he's still in the... he's still in the formidable stages of staffing and that kind of thing. It's amazing how long it takes. But I've talked to his chief of staff just the other day, and we're eager to continue our exchange of ideas. And he's already declared, as we did in the election, that the 9 veterans offices would be reopened, and they're working on that right now, and I'm grateful for that.
In talking about... that day you said you were going to resign. A lot of that was about, you know, your family issues, and a lot of there were a lot of politicians who stepped down after the end of the last Parliament for family concerns. And you were actually fairly honest. I reread that Ottawa Citizen interview you did, and given the impact on families, and you certainly weren't alone in that, is that an aspect you think that's maybe overlooked in terms of when people are called to or elected to government service?
It's overlooked not just by the public but by the candidate. You know, there are certain things in life like marriage and having kids that you just don't know what it's going to be like until it happens. And and politics is one of those things that throws you know, can sidewind, and you just don't know how to, you know, what's, you can't anticipate everything. And it did. It took its toll. I know in my closing remarks in my exit speech in Parliament, I asked the Speaker, I asked the House to reconsider the time they sit, maybe sit through the summer, and allow people Fridays off and be back in the riding, you know, different kind of protocols that could be followed. And I think they're going to take it seriously. I'm hearing talk of being back in the riding on Friday so people could have more time with their family.
Yeah, I think that's something that people don't understand either, is that, you know, they'll see that you're off for a month or two from Ottawa, but you're always on.
You're always on.
I noticed that this may seem whatever, but Snap Guelph, you know, when you're in town, you're always, who's at all the events? It's Cam Guthrie, Frank Valerio, whoever the MP is, and whoever the MPP is, and you're at everything.
Yeah.
And I do believe I've seen your kids in the Snap Guelph that times too. So it's like
it's
he's bringing the kids because he's got to be at this
thing.
I've
got to be with them.
So it sounds like you're never off.
Well,
that I don't think people appreciate that.
You're never. It's truly a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week job. And I remember when I spoke, I figured out that if we did 2 weeks on and 2 weeks off, 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off throughout the year, as opposed to these long breaks in the summer, it actually does give you better time with your family, because we did that for about a month in the spring of last year, and I noticed a difference psychologically when we actually had 2 weeks in the riding. So we wouldn't spend any less time in Ottawa. It would be better time in Ottawa and better time in the riding.
And business still gets done. Regardless.
And business still gets done.
It is a bit weird that the federal government gets a summer vacation.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is because in this state, I assume the House of Commons is air conditioned. I've only ever been up there in the winter, so I assume there's air conditioning.
Yeah,
so it's not a matter of discomfort.
No, not at all. We'll see what they come up with.
Yeah.
It's blocks of ice, though, right? Isn't it? Something like that.
Right. Dry ice.
Isn't the Renault coming? The Renault's coming soon.
You see the smoke coming out.
Yeah, there is supposed to be a renovation.
Yeah, no, it is being renovated. They're finishing the West Block and building a new parliament in the West Block as a temporary parliament. And when they do that, then they're going to rebuild and remove all the asbestos and everything else out of Center Block.
Amen.
Is there asbestos in Center Block?
Yes, yeah. Asbestos everywhere.
Yeah.
But we could do a whole other show on that, I think.
Yeah. Well, with you, Scotty, I know.
Yeah.
Speaking of your successor, Lloyd Longfield, when he was here during the campaign, I asked him, or we asked him, isn't it the royal we and me and Scotty and I, how he would be different as an MP from you. So I'll ask you kind of your spin on that in terms of how do you think Lloyd will be different from you in terms of serving as Guelph's MP?
Well, frankly, I'm hoping he's not too much different. And I supported Lloyd in the campaign because I believed he would be persistent and honest, transparent, certainly capable, available, accessible, all of those things. So, he'll brand himself differently than I. There'll be causes that he'll pursue that he'll identify that are now more important to the citizens of Guelph. I know back then, I was alert to what the people in Guelph wanted me to pursue, and I tried to do that, including my private member's bill on the only point of contact after death with the government should be Service Canada, Bill C-247, and other things. But I
which got royal assent right before summer.
The very last day we sat, I was sitting there going, "What is going on?" But yeah, it did get royal assent. But Lloyd's already identifying and stepping. I mean, with the refugee issue, for instance, I was at the ICC last night. And, he's one of the prime movers in making sure that things go well for the refugees that are coming to Guelph.
And that's a good point, too, because I think there's a lot of, fanfare who gets to be in cabinet. But, when you're on the back bench, you're not idle. You're not catching up on your naps. There's a lot of work that has to be done.
Absolutely.
And actually, the actual grunt work that's not giving press conferences or...
That's right. It's funny you mentioned that because I was thinking today while I was driving over here, what would I consider my legacy? Would it be what went on in Ottawa? And you can identify certain things like my private member's bill and stuff, but it really is the work that goes on in the riding and the people's lives whose lives you've changed here in the riding. People who needed somebody to come from Afghanistan to help them because their son was dying of cancer and they had no one else to turn to, and the government had turned them down and wouldn't let their brother or sister come, and being able to step in and bring them over, or the lady who wanted to become a Canadian citizen while she was in the hospice with a week left to live, and saying, you know what, we're going to step up, we'll help this woman, and we did, and managed to do that with the help of an accommodating judge in Ottawa who was prepared to swear them in over the phone. It's so many things that you can do. If you identify the need and you step up and do it, and it's what gets done in Guelph. I remember the first time I was up there, walking up towards the center block, the second or third day I was elected. David McGinty was walking with me, and he said, "Frank," he said, "they won't care how much you know, but they'll know how much you care." And you've got to show up. You show up to the needs of the people. It's your riding that needs you, and that's who you're here for, nobody else. So,
Well, I have a Parliament Hill nerd question in relation to this. I'm curious.
Not on this show, Scott.
I'm going to be honest about it.
Yeah.
You were also the deputy whip, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Can you explain? I mean, I have an idea what the whip does and the deputy whip, but what in terms of duties, what for the people, what does the deputy whip do?
Well, first of all, it makes sure I'm a house officer, so I make sure that order is kept within our party. I mean, there can be a lot of banter and disruption during question period and speeches, so I have to make sure that, you know, when the peace needs to be kept, I'm there to help keep the peace. I have to make sure that people show up to vote. You know, there are from time to time maverick or rogue MPs who don't show up to vote. So you've got to make sure you get them there. You have to make sure that they're alert to when the vote is. You mean people sit and talk during votes, and we've missed people will miss voting because, you know, because they're yammering and discipline. It's like being the vice principal.
That sounds like a job in and to itself.
It is
on top of everything else.
It is a job.
Come on, sit down and vote, you idiot. Yeah.
But I was. They gave me that as well as veterans critic at the same time. So I was doing double duty for quite a while. But it's an exciting job. It really is an exciting job.
What do you think your best day as MP was? Was there a best day, or is it a lot of little things?
My best day as MP was when we got the first time we got the Canada Access to Medications Regime Bill through. The Grandmothers for Africa, as they were then known, were pushing vigorously to allow the generic drug makers access to patents, so that the antiretrovirals could be made to get into Africa to fight AIDS. And the Conservatives were saying no. It was a minority government. We had to work hard. You would have thought it was a no-brainer, but we had to work hard at convincing certain Liberals and certain NDP to come on board. And I remember the Grandmothers for Africa coming up there day after day, lobbying people, lobbying everybody they possibly could to vote in favor of this bill. And on the day of the vote, we were sitting in Parliament, and normally the Speaker, he calls, you know, everyone in the fifth row that supports this motion, please stand. And people would stand up one at a time, you know, and then sit down, the other stands. Well, there was such a motion, everybody in the fifth row on the left, everyone all at once stood, and then everyone all at once in the fourth row stood. And it was a strong statement of how strongly we supported this bill, right? And the grandmothers were up in the lobby, up in the gallery, and they were watching, and they were crying. And there were many of us, including myself, that broke down crying. That was one of the most impactful moments. And frankly, the day that I convinced the Minister of Immigration, then Jason Kenney, to allow a fella to come from Afghanistan, I mentioned it earlier, to be with his sister whose son was dying of cancer. And he had been refused several times. And I crossed the floor and I stated his case and hardship case. And he said, well, I'll look at it. And it was several weeks later, and I was in the car going to the airport. And he called me and he said, Frank, we'll allow him to come. And picking up the phone, you know, my cell phone, and phoning the mother here in Guelph and saying, your brother can come from Afghanistan, phone him and tell him to pack his bags. And she just broke down crying, and I'm crying. I mean, it's just you have to be there to appreciate, frankly, the satisfaction that is associated with being able to help people like that.
And Jason Kenney, not an easy man to convince.
No, not at all. Yeah. I was often caught crossing the floor, sitting beside the opposition, the government, and begging for help, and caught on camera. But you know, you have to do these kinds of things if you're gonna get the job done. And I enjoyed doing it, and I persisted and never regretted one moment.
And what it sounds like is, as much as things get combative on Parliament Hill, it's not always so combative and so partisan that you can't get things done in a one-on-one way.
Well,
there's a big butt there.
There's a big butt there. Yeah, there's. I tried lots of one-on-ones with the Minister of Veterans Affairs, Julian Fantino,
and difficulty meeting veterans one-on-one.
Yeah, exactly. I've done a lot of one-on-ones with a lot of people, and frankly, got nowhere. Just got not interested. Mm-hmm. As logical as the request could be, or the amendment that might have been made to a bill. It was just, no, we've got our orders from the Prime Minister's office, and this is the way it's going to be, and go away. But, you know, sometimes these hardship cases, like I remember a refugee from Mexico that they were forcing back to Mexico, and they had quite legitimate concerns for their safety, not just their safety, their life. Mm. Again, it was one of the floor crossing moments, and I went across and convinced them, and they said, okay. And, you know, in the real individual cases, I was able to achieve more success than the larger things, you know, like trying to save the wheat board. I remember we spent, you know, a year trying to save the wheat board, and we were just totally unsuccessful in that.
Mm-hmm. In terms of perhaps you can shed some insight in terms of Prime Minister Trudeau's leadership style, in terms of how you think he'll do as Prime Minister, having watched him work as a Liberal leader and as the third party leader while you were Deputy Whip, which is a pretty high up position, working closely with the leader, too.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I was. I was part of his leadership team. We met every morning and strategized for the day. Justin has always been open and honest with us and always welcomed our opinions. I remember, you know, he invited me to his home with his wife and a few others to talk about electoral reform, some form of proportional representation or other forms. And, I mean, how many leaders will invite you to their home, have supper, and say, okay, let's get down to business and let's talk about why this is necessary and what form do you think it should take? Mm-hmm. And by the end of the conversation saying, okay, Frankie, go to it, bring a motion before, not just before caucus, but before convention in Montreal. And, you know, and now it became part of the platform. And now he's creating a committee that's going to look at our electoral system and bring back a new model in the next 18 months. So when he says I'm open-minded, I'm transparent, I'm willing to listen, it really is an organic process with him. It's from the ground up. He doesn't come in with preconceived notions of the way things should be. Mm-hmm. He wants to listen to Canadians. He's listening to our First Nations. You know, he went to Paris right away. We're going to find the solutions that Canada needs to contribute to global warming. He's the real thing.
Sounds like it when he's saying, get at her, Frankie.
Yeah. No, it's true.
He does sort of give that impression, and you know, hearing from you that it sounds true. So
yeah.
If he ever wants to come on, you guys are having a meal or something, say, hey, I know these guys in Guelph, and they're all right, you know, and they want to talk to you.
But I think the electoral reform is a particular point, because I think a lot of people feel if there's maybe one thing that's going to fall off the radar, it's that. But from the sound of it, this is going to be a legitimate thing.
Oh, I think so. Yeah. And there are too many people. I just met last week, I think it was, with Fair Vote Canada here in Guelph, and there are some very strong-minded, strong-willed, and very well-intentioned people that have some great ideas, and I don't think they'll let it fall off the rails.
Well, Steve Dick, like
Steve is the guy. Steve's the guy. I mean, he's the one who opened my mind to the whole idea, and you know, the light went on when I had several. He's a friend and a great fellow, and you know, what we had one conversation, and he said, "Frank, we're friends. I like you. I you know." But you don't represent everybody. Mm. And that's the problem with parliamentarians. You know, they get elected, and regardless of the plurality, they all of a sudden think they are the spokesperson for every single person in that riding. Mm-hmm. And they go up and become very territorial and possessive of their riding and assume that this is my riding. I'll speak for my riding. And they forget that there are a lot of people in their riding that didn't vote for them. Often, more than 50% didn't vote for them. And so you've got to be mindful that this is a very legitimate cause to reform our electoral system.
Well, you are back in town. You are back practicing law. But I know from your background, you were involved in several different community groups. Are you going to be doing some of that again?
Yeah, well, I'm actually heading back to Peru in January. I and a few others started an organization called Economic Development Solutions International. I would encourage your listeners to go to ed-si.com, ed-si.com. Look at the YouTube videos. We're doing some tremendous work in microfinancing of women in Central and South America who are developing small businesses, sustaining their families in a miraculous way. It's a fabulous thing.
Well, unfortunately, that wraps up our time with you. And yeah, time flies.
Went quick.
Yeah. If people want to get in touch with you, how can they do that?
fvalariat@smithvalariat.com. fvalariat@smithvalariat.com for any reason, advice, whatever. They want to talk politics? I'm still in withdrawal. I'm happy to talk to them anytime at all.
And I, of course, will see you around town. And
I hope so.
Yeah. And thank you again for all your work on our behalf on Parliament Hill and for everybody.
Adam, I remember you at the beginning back in 7-8 years ago when it all started with the by-election. And I've always appreciated your candor with me and our friendship.
Well, I appreciate it, too. Yeah. So, Frank Valeriat, thank you for stopping by today.
Thank you.
And we will be right back after some PSAs and some music. We have some very Guelph-centric music for the occasion. And we will have more fun and conversation coming up on Open Sources. You are listening to CFRU.ca, CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
This is K-Train Fitzsimmons playing the heavily distorted chromatic harmonica. You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM.
By the light of the disco ball, you look so good, you're giving it all. I know I've never felt so alive. You make me feel so happy inside.
And that was Evan Gordon. Evan Gordon from his CD Booty Shorts. Always want to say that in the air, Booty Shorts. Evan Gordon and the Sad Clowns. I believe the Sad Clowns are on that album as well, although they're... Oh, yeah, there we go. All songs performed by Evan Gordon and the Sad Clowns. They will be playing Stay Out of the Mall, and if you know your room, a numeral is 14. Saturday, December 19th with Blimp Rock, whom I personally really love, too. There's also a comedy break involved in that, too. The Making Box Brigade and Nick Flanagan. Not a comedy break. It says Jokes By, so... It's at the E-Bar, 41 Quebec Street, at 10 p.m. on Saturday, December 19th. 10 o'clock, all ages, and it's licensed as well. It's $8 admission, the non-perishable food donation, $10 at the door, and this is in support of the Canadian Cancer Society. So stay out of the mall, go to a great show. More info, go to vishkana.com. Yes, there is an inside scoop as to why that poster's up there. But yes, it's the 14th one, so it's been a long-standing charitable Christmas thing. So
and it's a good show. It's a laid-back show. It's
yes. It's and nice. Comedy this year, that's a bit of a change, isn't it? Yeah, I think so.
I think
so,
that's a first.
Check it out. You will not regret it.
Yeah.
And if you need a lawyer, contact. We know a guy.
Hurt in a car. It doesn't even work with... I mean, it works with William Attar. It was like some Buffalo lawyer. Hurt in a car, call William Attar. It doesn't quite work for Frank Valeriat yet. You need to...
Is your family having a civil war? Well, no. Anyway.
Speaking of lawyers...
yes.
Senator Mike Duffy, the Duffy trial has been going through part three. I think we're still on part three.
It's had so many parts, it's almost hard to...
I know. It's It's like a freaking trilogy. So it was actually the 60th day of the trial today. Wow. And it looks like court has been adjourned for the year. There will be more trial come 2016. But for much of the last week, actually the last 8 days of the Duffy trial, Mike Duffy himself has been on the stand. He was called by the defense. He is the defendant, but he was called to testify on his own behalf. And there was a lot of hype building up to this because a lot of people were suspecting he was going to leave no stone unturned in terms of his time and as a senator working with the PMO.
Well, it sounds like there was no stone unturned for his life. You know, I'm just a lowly reporter from PE Island, moved to Ontario, and I really wanted to be the Ontario senator. Yeah, there was this sort of, you know, I wouldn't say leaving all of this read into the record. I guess everybody knows a lot more about Mike Duffy than they probably ever did. Also, the fact that he has presented himself he says that he was the sacrifice.
Yeah.
There's been some sort of heavy language in terms of how this has gone down. He was sacrificed, you know, get Mulcair off of Harper's back, get Duff out of there. And there's a lot, I think there's a lot of truth to what he's saying. I don't think he has anything to gain by making stuff up. And of course, my absolute favorite is the image when he described Stephen Harper sitting in his undershirt, eating a hot dog, getting his shirt ironed. I mean, that's just, never mind the nude Harper painting. Somebody's going to paint that now and put it online just because, although Harper is yesterday's man now. But some telling stuff, too, and something that he said that kind of stuck with me, that when all this was going down, he was pleading for, he said, decency from all the born-again Christians who were throwing him to the lions. Mm-hmm. So he sort of opened the window a bit or the door a bit as he would look into the what seemed chaotic from what we knew at the time. And now he's just sort of confirming that. It was like there was all of this background going on and how much control that Harper and the higher-ups had over the party. And, you know, the crown is now chipping away at the spin because, of course, it's all spin.
Yeah.
Duff's a spin man, right? So we'll see in the ongoing, too. So, or they've adjourned, haven't they? Like that's.
I think they adjourned today, and it won't be back again. I think the defense did rest, actually. I'd have to double check.
They've all had enough as well.
It ended an hour ago. So that's how recent developments are. The thing with the hot dog seemed very, you know, all the king's men. You know, all that was missing was Harper talking in a Louisiana accent.
Dab of ketchup on the undershirt.
but I do wonder how much of it really is spin because he's playing himself as such the naive rube who, you know, begrudgingly took this position, begrudgingly, you know, did what the PMO told him to do. They hung him out to dry. He believed them so much. He was freaking Mr. Smith in this scenario. And, you know, he was betrayed by the system. In a sense, he was. But on the other hand, I mean, he flatly denied that he was petitioning for years, like all the way back to Chrétien to get a Senate seat.
Well, that was like one of the worst kept secrets, right?
It seemed to be known
that like Duff really wants to be a senator. Like it was.
Yeah.
It kept coming up. So if it keeps coming up, then there's some talk going on, whether it's in front of the scenes or behind the scenes, it's, you know,
right.
It's there.
And then on top of it all, he's like, well, I don't think I should do this. And they're like, no, trust us. It's okay. Just do it. And, like, you were a journalist. More than that, you're, like, probably one of the most well-known journalists in Canada.
On Parliament Hill.
That was his turf, right?
Yeah.
And at no point in your head did you say, I'm not going to do something because it smells wrong, but I'm not going to do it because it doesn't seem right. And, like, tell me you weren't that naive. I don't think he was that naive. And on top of it all, if he was a begrudging conservative senator from PEI, why was he going to all those rubber chicken dinners? Why was he letting them fly him around the country to raise money for the party and for individual candidates? You know, why was he being a conservative mascot? And I think that's maybe some of what the Crown was trying to get at, although the Crown talked to him for 2 days and his own attorney talked to him for six.
Mm-hmm. And that it's when it was starting to when Duffy's star was starting to fade. Well, that one incident in particular in BC where they kept him away from the event, and it wasn't clear as to whether that he knew that it was canceled, but he was going anyway to see his daughter in a play or something. And this all, I think the expenses were something like $8,000, and it was probably more, But there, it sounded, he made it sound like they were trying to keep him away from this thing because they wanted to shine more light on, I think it was Gary Lunn,
yeah,
who was running head to head with Elizabeth May, and it was something to do with the torch. You know, they were very big on this. Oh, there's something, if whether it's the torch or the Stanley Cup or, you know, a Gordie Howe hockey puck or whatever, or Gretzky himself. It was sort of like the optics have to be a certain way. So I think that part of it, it's true in that it's like, okay, if we don't want you there, you know, just don't bother coming. But, yeah, in terms, yeah, it's weird, this kind of naivete he's putting forward, like, oh, I don't know. But, and also that they're saying that, or they threatened that they would take his job away. When has a senator lost, has a senator ever lost their job? Ever?
I don't think so.
I think you would have to murder somebody. And even then, it'd probably be like, well, we're going to have an inquiry. You know, like, you'd probably still get a check of some kind.
Well,
because
I think
there's, you know, Brazeau ain't paid. Wallen is still there. They don't want to censure
her anymore.
Well,
that's why the Brazeau thing was such a big deal. It's because it was criminal charges, which meant he could have lost his Senate seat.
Yeah.
Because that's what it takes. It's actual criminal charges because he can't be a senator from prison.
And that,
I presume.
And that's what we're saying. And the name off the top of my head, I can't remember.
Martin, are you thinking of?
No, not Martin. He was grooming the young girl.
That's Martin, isn't it?
Not Martin. People, if you know, call us.
Isn't it Don Martin?
Don Meredith,
yeah.
For 10 points, what is the name of the senator creep who's still there and nobody likes? Yeah, so he should probably just step aside, but it's not going to happen. So
no. But it is funny, the Gary Lund connection, the Sandwich Gulf Islands things, because that was kind of a bombshell last Thursday when he basically said that that was an inside job, that the robocalls on Sandwich Gulf Islands.
Yeah.
The incident, quite famous, Julian West, the NDP candidate, stepped down, said he wasn't going to run. It was after the deadline to add or remove names from the ballot. So his name was still on the ballot, even though he wasn't running. There are robocalls sent out to NDP supporters to hey, get out tomorrow and vote for Julian West. And then Gord Lund won by a slim margin. And this was 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Duffy says that was a conservative inside job. That was robocalls, I mean. They were taken from the conservative.
Very matter of fact, yeah. Well, that's not a surprise. I mean, we've said here before, too, that we'll never know the whole story, but
no.
I mean, it's pretty much a given now that they were doing that. So, yes, you should feel guilty. And Pierre, if you still want to come on, faint hope that Pierre will come on.
Justin and Pierre head to head. That's the
first
show. Yeah,
let's get them both
year.
In and we can put a bag over his head or something so we don't need to know who he really is. But. That's right.
The thing, the thing that gets me is that there's is about Duffy's testimony. It's the stark difference between the way he wants to be viewed and the way he was. Because I remember when this started to hit the fan, and he was making a speech somewhere. It was like one of these fundraising dinners, and the press was waiting for him outside, and they were like there by the back exit in case he's running, and he's, you know, going to his car and he's making jokes about it, and he's like, ah, you guys are in the press, and you know,
he doesn't say too much now when he's walking past.
Yeah, no, he's like deathly silent. But
night.
I mean, he was mocking them at the time for staying so close to this story, which he thought was a non-story,
as he used to do.
Yeah, and so either you took it seriously, either you had genuine concerns about what you were being told to do. Or you were the guy still going to the fundraising dinners and mocking the stupid press for bothering you about lame stuff. I don't.
And that's the thing. When you do that, you get your day, right?
Mm.
But he's still very insistent throughout the whole thing that he didn't break any laws and no rules were broken. Whether Deep Pockets right or not was helping him out. And it seems that it wasn't. Is there going to, you know, there will be a tightening of the rules, one would think, after all this, or at least more accountability. And I think that may be the one thing that this will bring to light, because he's not going to go, if somebody's out there thinking Mike Duffy's going to go to jail, he probably isn't, for a number of reasons, including his health, which has come up quite a bit on the trial as well, and that he's not a healthy specimen, probably from all the partying and whatever. No, seriously, though. I mean, it's, you live that kind of lifestyle, and I think that was part of it, too, the whole jet setter, oh, here comes Duffy to raise us some money. I mean, there's a certain, you know, foie gras thing that goes with that, right? It's like champagne and caviar dreams. I guess, well, he still got his cottage anyway, so he could probably sell up in Ottawa and just go back to the cottage.
That's the other thing.
Is it winterized yet? I don't know. Probably.
I don't know, but that's another interesting part is apparently that came out today, so you might not have seen it yet. He told Nigel Wright that he was poor. He wasn't poor, but he told Nigel Wright he was poor so that he wouldn't have to pay it back. That was another weird bit that came out.
I'm just a poor reporter from PE Island. Yeah.
And speaking of people who get what's coming to them, Martin Shkreli. That
made my day,
CEO.
I have to say.
Yeah. Apparently he took money out of his own hedge fund and put it to non-business use.
There's been a lot of arrests this week, so it's that one I think is the cherry on top. So
yeah. Speaking of
for another show.
Speaking
of
Law and Order and Justice, this one's obviously a bit more serious. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission brought its final report. I mean, there are already the 94 recommendations announced, and it's the same 94 recommendations, but it is the final report. The commission is done now. They had a ceremony in Ottawa. What was different about this ceremony? The Prime Minister was there. The Justice Minister was there. The Indigenous and Northern Affairs Minister was there, and they were all participants. And there was actually some follow-up, because not only has there been a missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls inquiry been called, but the Prime Minister actually had follow-up meetings after the commission was submitted its report. 3,000 pages in all, by the way. And then there was this today that the municipal, provincial, and federal governments have all got together to approve the building of this road to the Shoal Lake 40 First Nation, which is a First Nation on the Manitoba-Ontario border, but have been separated from the mainland by a man-made lake for how long? It's been about 100 years, hasn't
it? Yes, it's some ridiculous amount of time, yeah.
But they haven't had clean water there in 20 years. Mm-hmm. They've been had a boiled water advisory since 1997, and they have no road access. They're on this island with no road. They have a ferry in when the water is in liquid form, but when it's in ice form, they have to walk miles across the frozen lake. And I think this is probably in terms of truth and reconciliation, things like this, like 20 years and you've had to boil your water or lug 20 liter jugs of water across the frozen lake to your home. That's, I mean, as much as the truth and reconciliation deals with real crimes, I think that's, you know, just as equally a crime.
Yeah, and I think that's what we're seeing from the new government. Because, I mean, 20 years ago, it was a Liberal government. So it's not, you know, we've seen Liberal Conservative throughout the years. Nothing has changed. And I think that's what's different now. And I think it was kind of a bit of what, like, Frank was alluding to earlier, in that we've got a bit of a different bird here with Trudeau. Like, he's not, he was very emotional. I mean, you can't just put that on. That's not acting. I mean, and in turn, I think made everybody present emotional as well, in that. And it's, you know, it's making this impression far greater than just beyond the committee itself, or the Truth and Reconciliation beyond itself, and the meetings that they're having, and that people are seeing that this guy means it. When he says that his relationship with First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people is important, he actually means it. This isn't just flapping the gums, as has been the case probably since back in the days of, you know, the original Indian Act.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like there's definite change in there. And I think that Indigenous people in Canada are feeling this as well. You kind of see it in the reactions and just the sort of streeters when they talk to people and say, well, what do you think of this? And then they say, oh, man, this is just such a – it feels like a weight has been lifted. So there's definite change in the air. And as you're saying about the highway being built, which I didn't know about yet, that there is change. But, of course, to address all of this, to move into the future – there's a harsh reality of the past to deal with, too. And
yeah,
it sounds like that is getting rolling for sure. Because this, I mean, some of the stuff that's come out in the inquiry, I think most Canadians really, truly have no idea what the legacy of the residential school system was, and there's people just disappearing. You know, they're saying it's how 3,000 plus died, but then it's, you know, Justice Sinclair is saying that it's probably way more than that, and they'll never know because the records are no good.
Well, they're saying that there might be up to 6,000 who were just, like, missing in action, basically.
And that would take, like, a lifetime of forensics to find out, even if they do ever find out. Yeah, I mean, there's some people in this that will just be completely lost time.
Yeah.
It was also interesting, too, this week that the OPP's report came out. I don't know if that was coincidence or was meant to be, in that they had said that they were going to go through the records as well from back through to the 50s,
yeah,
and go over unsolved cases of indigenous people who had been killed. It seems there are 8 unsolved. I think it was 54 women and 126 men. And there are still outstanding cases. And they're sort of putting this appeal out to the people who possibly know anything to come forward, regardless, as long as within that range. I think it's 56 to the present day.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, too, in particular, which I thought was kind of ballsy, let's say, on Trudeau's part, is saying, I'm going to go for a papal apology. We want the Pope to apologize.
Yeah.
I think it was 60% of the residential schools were run by the Catholic Church, and they haven't chimed in. Anglicans have apologized. The United Church have apologized. And they were the smaller slice of mm-hmm. residential schools, but still accepted the fact. And that was years ago, too, that they, I believe it was at least 20 years ago, the first apologies came out in their apologizing for their part in that. But there's been nothing. I think there's been, you know, probably talk from God. I think Pope Francis may have said a thing or two. But in terms of an official apology.
I know Pope Francis has.
Or Pope Benedict, sorry. Benedict did have some kind of, he made some kind of statement.
Yeah.
That's not an apology.
It's, no, he kind of recognized there was a situation. And Pope Francis has made similar outreach to South American indigenous people who, you know, had residential school-like situations.
Well, the Vatican's paying through the nose for a lot of things right now, so.
Yeah, there's a lot of roosters coming home to roost on their part.
So that may be part of the reluctance. It's like, uh-oh, we'll have to pay these people too.
Yeah.
You'd hope not. Francis does seem like a new deal, kind of, but, I mean, it's still the Vatican.
Yeah, I mean, there's still politics afoot. I mean, mm-hmm. the Vatican is still its own country and everything. I think what one of the things I was struck by in Trudeau's comments was being in school and literally having the teacher telling them to turn the page over on the history of residential schools.
Yeah, that's something.
That was kind of a powerful remark, even though it was kind of like an aside, an anecdote to get a speech rolling. And by the way, he didn't have to be there to give a speech. This is something he could have parceled out to Carolyn Bennett. And
sure.
That would have been fine.
Yeah.
Because Carolyn Bennett's already been fairly active on that portfolio. So he didn't have to be there, but there is a deep sense that he felt it important that he be there. And he also gave credit to the previous government for issuing the apology for the residential schools mm-hmm. as well, which was a classy touch. But I think Justice Murray St. Clair was right when he says, like, part of reconciliation is going to be education and making sure people know about this history and remember what happened rather than just turning the page, as Trudeau alluded to.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely what has to happen. And I think, having a look at the Truth and Reconciliation website, I think even embedded within that, they're saying there's a section, and I thought it was unusual, but it makes complete sense, things that you can do. I mean, you don't mm-hmm. often see that. It's just like a report comes out and it goes into the file or, you know, nowadays it goes on the computer. But
it's a PDF you can download whenever.
It's a PDF,
whenever,
you download the report and you go, okay, but then nothing comes of it. But I think that's what we're going to see come out of this is that things will happen. I mean, to say that they're going to adopt all 94 recommendations of the commission, that's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you know, it wasn't the old, well, we'll think about it or we'll see what we can do. It's like, no, we are going to do this
mm-hmm.
the best we can. And of course, if they only get to 92, somebody's going to say, they only got to 92. But it's kind of like the refugees, right? Oh, it's only 200 came. There's always some, no matter what you do, there's always somebody that's going to say that. But I mean, I'm not easily impressed when it comes to this kind of stuff. But I tell you, this is a sea change because right. this never would have happened under the old regime. Never.
Well, and when I was talking to Frank before the show, it's like, well, I think it's always better to have government be aspirational and say, we're going to do 92 things or however many things. And, you know, if you get to 2/3 of them, great. It's better than making 10
or
promises that are just
degrees.
Lame that you're, yeah, that yeah. you're not going to. Wow, that's another,
story but, for another show. Yeah.
But then, like, the 94 recommendations, you know, some of them are fairly simple. Some of them are things like changing oaths and, you know, saying that you're going to adopt the UN Declaration on Indigenous People, like asking the Pope for an apology. What's the cost of that? It's like a phone call or a sit-down meeting when, you know, the two of you are in the country together. Some of it is there will be costs attached to it, mm-hmm. like building a monument to residential schools in every province and territorial capital, developing post-secondary education programs to study and maintain indigenous languages. Although there is some progress on that front, there's a Saskatchewan program. The 24 universities in Saskatchewan have an agreement that they're going to build a program for, I think it was for Aboriginal history.
And make it mandatory too, right?
Yeah, to close the gap in that kind of for Aboriginal students, for them to get an education, post-secondary education, and all that, to try and address that in some way. But that's like 24 universities in Saskatchewan mm-hmm. all saying we're going to work together on this, which goes back to the aspirational thing. But I do find it interesting now that what we see is the critics who were, you know. Once upon a time, I think a lot of these people were saying, "Oh, well, what's the point of an inquiry going to be?" Now they're saying, "Well, how much is it going to cost? How much is like enacting all these 94 recommendations going to cost? Like, we need a costed plan and analysis and all that." And I think that seems to be the new argument is money, which. I mean, yeah, I understand cash is tight right now. I understand basic economics, but at the same time. We're talking about, Shoal Lake, who hasn't mm-hmm. had clean water that comes out of a tap for 20 years.
Which is a direct responsibility yeah. of the federal government and yeah. goes back way back. Now, this absolutely has to happen because Trudeau Jr. and I are the same age. And I don't have a specific example I can go back to. But to sort of gloss over this history, this is probably... I would say the worst chapter in Canadian history in terms of we think of ourselves as so great and kind mm. and friendly and we go do this and we go help other countries and peacekeeping and blah, blah, blah. And then you open the cupboard and there's this. Mm-hmm. It has to be dealt with. Now, I mean, as you say, some of the things with the costs will be larger than others. Some of the things, an apology doesn't really cost anything, does it?
No.
But when you're dealing with cultural genocide, you as a nation and as a body of people have to deal with that. And these, whoever it is saying, oh, well, we're going to watch the costs. And it's like, it has to be done. Yeah. And regardless of what period of time it takes, the report is out now. That took six years at least just to get to this point.
Yeah.
It's going to take time to get, nothing is going to happen overnight with the rest of it. But the wheels are in motion now, and it absolutely has to happen.
And it's not entirely complete, too, because out of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, there was that working group. To find out what happened to those 6,000, up to 6,000 missing children.
As best they can.
Yeah, as best they can, yeah. Because there's unmarked graves in places and, roles were incomplete. And it's just, astounding. And everybody knows a kid in their life, whether it's a niece or a nephew or your own children or, neighbor kids, and just picture... the 5-year-old boy or girl next door just being taken somewhere hundreds of miles away and them never coming back, which is what happened to almost 10,000 kids.
Or ones that tried to go home and died. And it's just it's unbelievable. Absolutely.
So, in the face of all that, I think cost is a relatively minor conversation. But I think that seems to be the next wall that people who want true truth and reconciliation are going to bump up against is the cost issue. Well, that's kind of a downer note to leave things on, but there it is. That is all for this week's edition of Open Sources. Programming note for you, we're going to be taking a holiday break the next couple of weeks, but we will have new episodes. We're pre-taping a couple of episodes. We are going to have our favorite political movies episode next week, and then we'll have our year-end recap on New Year's Eve. So stay tuned for that. You can go to opensourcesguelph.com for more details and commentary. We are on Facebook at Open Sources News. Wire, and of course on Twitter at @OS_Guelph. On Podbean, find the podcast. It is the Guelph Politicast channel. You can listen to us anytime on whatever device you listen to find podcasts on. I am at Adam A. Donaldson on Twitter, or you can go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Twitter, Scotty Hertz on Facebook, and the Spanner Book. I posted a thing and made the rounds. So, over the holidays is more time, so I might do a bit more of that. But I'll also be here, so what am I doing New Year's? New Year's Eve, I'll be here. I'll be spinning the show, so listen to the show. Don't call me, but you can.
And I believe, is Stacey here?
I don't see her, but that doesn't mean she isn't here.
So. All right. Well, there may be DJ Sounds Good to Me at the top of the hour here on Staff for You, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. In case you don't hear from us till the new year, Merry Christmas, and stay tuned for our specials. See you next week.
Happy holidays to you.